Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We've got a problem tonight, and we'll try to go through it together and get some understanding. The problem of pain and suffering has exercised the minds of men right through history. It isn't just a religious question, that's not the issue. All kinds of people have addressed themselves to this problem. Philosophers have contemplated it, trying to find out its value and how it has its place in human affairs. And then all kinds of people have addressed themselves to it as a problem that needs alleviating in some way. How to produce healing. Psychologists, psychiatrists, doctors, nurses, a whole army of people throughout the world are devoted to this, as well as that kind of compassion that each of us shows to another when the other is suffering. And we're all aware of this, and not there's nobody here who hasn't suffered pain, who hasn't had to endure sorrow. And it's not an easy subject to have a look at. There are no slick answers, no glib replies to the question. I'm not going to give you tonight, you know, a kind of one-off answer that's going to deal with everything, because it won't deal with everything. There is nobody who can, except God himself. And you'll see that as we go along. Atheists, agnostics, well, they've got to put up with it. They just have to deal with it within the confines of their own thinking. If there is no God, or they think there is no God, then it doesn't remove the problem. It's still there and now has to be dealt with. As far as I know, evolutionists don't deal with it. They don't talk about the evolution of pain and sorrow and its ultimate removal, at least not so far as I'm aware. It's a great problem. And even if you are a believer, it doesn't remove the problem at all. It may give us a different angle from which to view it, but it doesn't remove the problem. In fact, sometimes the problem is even greater for a believer than for an unbeliever. If you believe, for example, that you came, or mankind came out of the recesses of nothingness in the past, and is going on to we know not where, then you don't have a problem in the sense of having to allocate blame or seek an answer to pain and suffering. But if you are a believer, then you do have a problem. And so it's usually believers who ask certain questions. And those questions are not removed by total faith either. They still remain in some form or another. You know, the kind of question, why me, when suffering comes? Why my baby? Why that good woman? And so we can think of a thousand questions that all of us could ask. You know the people you've met from time to time, your good neighbor who contracts cancer, and your bad neighbor who goes in enjoying himself and dies at 87. And the inequality of these things, you see, it's the unfairness, the apparent unfairness of things that we seek to grapple with in our minds. And this has happened right throughout the ages. Indeed, there is a whole book, one of the longest in the Bible, a whole book devoted to this subject of suffering. People have regarded that book as one of the monumental works of literature, quite apart from the fact that it's set within the Bible. It is a most extraordinary book. It concerns a man who was a good man, an upright man, the kind of man you would have wanted to deal with in business, or the kind of man you would have wanted for your husband or your father. He was that kind of person. And then suddenly he got sick with everything at once. All kinds of tragedy overtook him. His goods were wiped out by storm. His sheep, his cattle, his camels, his servants, then his children, all taken away in a flash, all damaged by great tragedy. And then finally, it hit him, and that was the worst of it. A dreadful form of suffering leprosy seems to have taken hold of him. So that he's lost everything. Even his wife now turned against him. And it's no use believing in God. You just curse God and die. Forget it. That's what you should be doing. Just get ready to go. Now, she was grappling with a problem too. In fact, her problem was one degree worse because she had a sick husband as well. But she couldn't cope with it. He got friends. In fact, some of them travelled a very long way to meet him. He was a man held in high esteem. And so they came along to see him. Three friends. They were articulate friends. But when they saw him, they were staggered. Why? Why Job? Why like this? What a state to be in. We can hardly believe it. It took them a week to get over the shock. And they weren't involved in the pain and suffering except just by looking at their friends. And then the three friends began to argue. And they had all the classic arguments about suffering. You can have the kind argument, can't you? And none of these, remember, none of these arguments will wash in the end, totally. They just will not. You can't wear these arguments. Let's take the first one. Only the first argument they had was, it's all for your good. Now that's an understandable argument. That's the kind of argument we hear often, isn't it? You'll be stronger when you come through this. Now, it's a standard argument, but it's got flaws shot through it all over the place. I mean, the answer to that question was, you don't need to tell me that my children have died just to do me good. What kind of God is that? Took my children away to do me good. Now, you want to see right away that there's a difficulty in that argument. But one of them was fluent in this argument. Whom the Lord loves, he chastens. And you must be somebody whom the Lord loves. And others said, you haven't been all that you seem to be. You're not the upright Job that we know. You're a different man, that's what it is. You've got two sides to your character and God's found you out. That's what it is. And so God has punished you. So that's the other way, isn't it, of looking at problems. There was something wrong. It's the kind of thing that you and I sometimes do, isn't it? Well, you know the kind of life they've been leading. It isn't surprising that this has hit them, is it? We all do it. You'd have been satisfied if it had been the man on that side that was hit, wouldn't you? You'd have said his life was bad and therefore he got hit by whatever it is. And that is just a standard explanation, trying to marry up what's happened with what we can see or what we think we can see. And the other one took the other line. You've had it so good, haven't you? You've had it good, Job. And I'll tell you what, you've been selfish. You've neglected the widow. You haven't helped the poor. And God is now punishing you for that. That's another argument, isn't it? All these are, in fact, the standard arguments that the three friends bring out. And there's another one who comes along and tries to lead him nearer to God. And all the time, Job is saying, this isn't right. I'm not the man that you're talking about. It isn't like that with me. I haven't been neglectful in the way that you say. I'm not a wicked man. Maybe the Lord is chastening me, but this is tough, says Job. I just want to know. I'd like to talk to him. I'd like to tell him how I feel. If only he knew, then I'm sure it wouldn't happen. It would all go away. Now that's the picture. And that goes on for chapter after chapter after chapter in Job. It's a marvellous, marvellous scene as one goes through it. And one can see all one's own arguments there. It isn't that those three friends of his, who in fact, you know, we talk about Job's comforters, the people who come along to comfort us and only make us worse. You know, the kind of person who goes along and eats all the patient's grapes at the hospital.
We know the kind of person. Well, these three friends of Job, they weren't wicked men. But this situation was too big for them to grapple with either. You see, what they tried to do was to provide an explanation, like we all do. We all look for an explanation for suffering. I mean, there's a problem as to why you should look for an explanation for suffering, isn't there? We don't look for an explanation why we've got blue eyes. I mean, we might know an explanation, but we don't look for it. Or why our face is shaped this way or that. We don't look for it. We haven't got to satisfy ourselves. It's just interesting that for whatever reason, we connect pain and suffering somehow with morals and fairness. We wouldn't mind, in a kind of way, though this argument is false as well, if our pain and sorrow were measured out to us according to how bad we'd been. We wouldn't mind that. That's what we say. It's not true. I'll perhaps take you through that in a moment or two's time. It's another phony argument. Now, all these are all set out in book after book after book. You may have been in this situation yourself and had to go through it. You may actually have been asking all these questions and more. Now, the interesting thing is that God does speak in the book of Job. At the end, God speaks. And he doesn't say a word about Job's suffering. Not a single word about it. It might have been, as though it had never been. God doesn't say, "Well done, Job. You bore that well." Wasn't as bad as it might have been, was it? I understand it. I'll explain it to you. Not a word. Not one word about it. And what's more, Job doesn't in fact start asking God either about it. Because something else happens that changes the situation. God speaks to Job and he asks him questions. "Tell me, Job, could you make the tide turn on the seashore? Do you know how the ice is formed? Or why your garments are warm when the south wind blows? Do you know the time when the wild goats calve?" And he asked him 1,001 questions about the world in which he lives, about which Job is not asking any questions. He's got more sense than try to answer all these questions. He just accepts it. And the Lord God says, "And all of that is in my hands." "Tell me," he says to Job, "were you there when I made the world? When I laid the foundations of it, were you there? Can you bind the sweet influences of Pleiades, the seven great stars? Tell me, Job, can you?" And in the end, Job says, "Lord, I've been asking the wrong question." And he no longer asks God any questions, because now he sees that he's surrounded by infinite wisdom and infinite power, all of which are there for the service of man. And now he knows that his problem is contained within that power. Whatever it is, he should have bound it together with one piece of information that he did have, or most probably had, which is this: "Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" The God who binds all these things in perfect harmony, and wondrous harmony they are, you know, marvellous, marvellous harmony they are. You'll know as well as I do, for example, just north of Spitsbergen, off the coast of Norway, near the Arctic Circle, a babe is born, a baby bird. When it's 5 months old, it will set off on its 12,000 mile journey south of South Africa. 12,000 miles. It's never been before. It'll fly high when the weather's bad, fly low when it's not. It chooses its route. I heard a program on him, and where the scientists were saying amongst themselves, you know, the kind of question you and I might ask, how does it do it? And they said, well, I think it plots its course by the stars. The other one said, it may be by the magnetic field. And then they said, it may be both. Or it may be something else. Because so the bird comes south and spends its summer there. And then flies north and spends its summer there. And so it continues having this great 24,000 mile journey. This little thing. This tiny thing. I went into the cabin of the jumbo jet the other day and watched what there was, this great array of dials and lights, and the pilot and co-pilot sitting there with two computers working for them, ticking off the miles, saying that's how far we've got to go to our next stop. There it is, look, you can see the miles being knocked off one at a time. And I said, what is that, great grandson? Well, it's here, look, there it is, same time. I said, where's your radar at? He says, there, I've got my radar there. I said, what can you see by the radar? And then he explained. And knew exactly where he was. So you've got to have it with all these things going on, linking him to the ground. And this little bird, there it is, holding its head, all from its birth. And we don't know how he does it, any more than we know how the salmon find their way back into the river from which they came when first they came into existence. Or the eels that cross the Atlantic from the Saragossa Sea into the little streams of Britain. Nobody knows. Don't even know the life of the bee. And all the other creatures of the world. There's wisdom locked away in them. And this is what was put to Job. And Job said he hadn't asked the right question. And he was satisfied. And then began to lean upon God. And in the end, God marvelously blessed him. Now you may say, well, that's all very well, but it doesn't answer the question. Well, that's true. And there isn't any answer to certain questions. It's no use our looking for an answer as to why she came into that accident. As to why that baby is born in that way. For the individual cases, there is no way in which you can see our the answers to them. We can see answers if we don't wear our seatbelt and we have a crash and go straight through the window. We can understand that. And then we can't, because we still don't know why we had the crash. There is no way in which we've got wisdom enough to solve all the problems. So in probing all these things and seeking an answer, it's better to be forced back onto the way of Job. You know that punishments by pain and sorrow are not distributed in proportion to the badness of people, are they? They are not. We all know that. It isn't that the bad get it all and the good go scot-free. Sometimes the thing is completely changed. And it's the good that get it all and the bad go scot-free. Our world is like that. That's what we don't like. That's where we want to get fairness in. We think if we can to redress it. But at this time of year, in Britain, the gardens of Britain are waking up. Not that our winter has been particularly hard this last winter, but as you know, our gardens all go to sleep. They're not like yours, where when we walked this afternoon, I was told that this is what it's like on our winter days, and I said, well, this is just what it's like on our summer days. That's the kind of sort of light and warmth that we have on the best of our summer days, and these are your winter days. For our winter, everything goes to sleep. Sometimes it goes rock hard, the ground goes rock hard, and then everything's covered by snow. And then just as things begin to change and the snow begins to melt, then you get that wonder that as the snow actually melts, there is a snowdrop flower in bloom. Right there. You actually see it in bloom, emerging. And then the purple and the yellow-orange crocus breaks through. And the daffodils push their way up until they break with their bells and wondrous yellow colour. And all at once I saw
a host of golden daffodils, as Wordsworth said. And that's what it's like. And the cherry trees come out, and the almond blossom appears. The hawthorn hedges on the English lanes all begin to appear. And then the gardens of the houses all come alive. And one always feels about this, whoever one is, oh, I like this. This is what I would love to have. Whether we can care for the garden or plant it is another matter, but we just love to see it, just to go along, or just to catch the scent here and there. It's almost as though there is a relationship between men and gardens. It's almost as though there is, as though there's a sort of an instinctive relationship between man and a garden. So there's something very satisfying about it. And all the poets have written about it, as you know, and said all the kinds of things that take us into raptures, and we believe, because they tell us the things that we ourselves feel, but they say it in words that we could never use. You see, according to the Bible, everything began in a garden. That's where it began, the Garden of Eden. There was no toil there at all. There was enjoyment, and there was occupation, but there was no pain, and no sorrow, and no death. None of those things at all. God had made all things. He had planted the garden, and Adam and Eve were placed in it. The angels of God used to visit it. You can tell the idyllic place that it must have been. The whole of Eden, a large place, it got three great rivers in it, so it was a very large place, spreading right over into the area that we now know as Mesopotamia, and straight out to the Mediterranean coast. And within that was the garden that God had planted. Exactly where it was, no one is quite sure. And Adam and Eve had nothing to do in the sense of, they didn't have to work every day or anything like that. They didn't have the burdens that we have associated with our lives. They had total freedom before God, except for one thing, and that is that God wanted them to acknowledge that he was the giver of everything. In other words, that they would have a relationship with God, that the garden was the Lord. And by his grace, they were in it. That all the things that they saw, the beauty that they experienced, the creatures that were there, the sky above them, the stars at night, they were all of God's hand, and that there was his divine power and Godhead reflected in the things that they could see. That wondrous, satisfying stability of the sky and the rhythm of everything. The sunrise was regular. You could follow it through, and so was moonrise and moonset and star rise and star set. And there was a cycle of all the things of the garden that they produced their fruit in their season. There was a wonderful assurance in the things that there were there. But Adam and Eve just kicked over the traces. They just wanted to do their own thing like everybody else does. And that's when the trouble began. May I just point out to you, because I don't know of any other book that explains the origin of pain and sorrow. I don't know any other book, anything that is in any way so satisfying. Ask yourself, do I know of a totally satisfying explanation for the origin of pain? Because after all, the creatures who've got it don't want it. This is what we want, so it isn't as though we've urged it on and produced it. Oh, we know that pain serves purposes in some time, don't we? Like when somebody slammed the car door on my hand, I knew right away that my hand was there. Couldn't get it out, though, but I had to shout for somebody else. But pain was something that was useful in telling me that something was wrong. We are all aware of that, aren't we? Are we not? We have toothache. Or our eyes ache in a very unusual way. I mean, we want to seek some kind of help. We know what we've done something wrong with our back. We lean over in that stupid way that most of us do lean over, you know, as far as we can to pick something up that's too heavy, and then, oh, there it is, and we're like this, you know, walking around.
We all know that, and we got the indication. We'd done something wrong. If we didn't get the indication, we'd run into real trouble. I've been in a leper colony, and I've seen the real trouble. They've lost all the feeling in their fingers, or in their feet. And as a consequence, they knock them, they burn them, they injure them. And so they're in terrible trouble. So we understand that pain and sorrow, in that sense, is useful. It's a kind of indicator that we're under attack. But for the origin of everything, of those other sufferings, not these safeguard sufferings, but the others, I know of no other place than the third chapter of Genesis. Now, I'd like you to just look at it with me. Now, it may not satisfy you to begin with. This is after the sin. I just want you to notice just some words that there are here. That's all. I'm not going into the account or the theology of it. I'm just going to look for the words that tell us something. In verse 10, Adam said, "I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid." Now that's another form of pain and sorrow, is it not? Now that's without having anything actually wrong with us. We can also experience this matter of fear, terrifying fear. Fear that can absolutely paralyze us. You know the kind of thing you have when you have a real nightmare, right? A real nightmare. The kind of thing when even you're awake, you're not awake. The nightmare's got you. And there's a horrible and terrifying fear that grips you. It may not be rational, but it's there. The kind of fear that we've had when we were nearly in an accident. We break out in a cold sweat. Or when we've got to go through an ordeal. The doctor says, yes, it will have to be an operation. And then the fear that takes us. This is the origin of fear. This is the origin of fear. This book tells us the origin of all these things. Now a little further then, because in verse 15 we read, "And I will put enmity." So without looking into what the enmity is about, here is the origin of enmity. That is, hating things and strife between parties, whatever the parties are. Our world is full of that, isn't it? We live in a country surrounded by it. In a world that is partly antagonistic to you. And we know that. That's what our world is like, isn't it? That's not fair. The world isn't being fair. It's not living by fairness. It's on its own thinking and just has a go. And so the plane, the southern way is now, was in Cyprus, has been there now for 6 days up to this present time. Somebody beaten, somebody shot. And so there are people in that plane, the pilot himself with a gun against his head, more than one. They've been going through, we know what they've gone through, pain by fear. Nothing's happened to most of them at all. They haven't been touched physically, most of them. But fear can kill them, and we're aware of that. And then enmity, that relationship between the PLO and the Jews, or whatever it is. And we all understand that well enough, do we not? We understand it. Enmity may be a means of achieving man's ends. That's another thing, isn't it? Sometimes people do this. So you have political parties within and without your own country that have enmity towards one another because they are seeking certain ends. Here's the origin of enmity. Didn't exist before. So now we've got fear and we've got enmity. Verse 16. "Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow." And that's the first time we have sorrow in the Bible. So sorrow came into the world when sin came into the world. Fear, enmity, sorrow. So we've got three things now, three major things. We all understand that in this matter of childbirth and pain. Childbirth pain is the second most intense pain known to man. Strange, that, isn't it? And that's not a sickness either. That's just to do with birth. You probably want to know what the most intense pain is, and that's, well, the kidney stone. And what the excruciating pain that you get with that. So they say, by measuring these things. One of those things I can't have experienced, and the other one I haven't, so far. But those of you who have will know exactly what that thing means. Now go down to verse 19. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return to the ground, for out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. So toil and death. Now, these are the next things. So we've got the whole spectrum of things here. We know what their origin is. Now, their origin is in sin. So now we know that pain and sorrow and death and fear are all related in the first instance to sin. That was why Job's friends said he must have done a special sin then, Job, to be in the condition you're in, because they too related pain and sorrow to actual sin. That isn't a true argument, as we shall see. What is being said here is that the origin of these things lies in sin. They were not there before, they are there afterwards. And bad as they may seem to be, they're not the worst things that could happen, are they? If Hitler couldn't die, then think what the world's problems would be. If all the most evil people you can ever think of could not die, they just went on living, then think of the condition of our world. And you now understand that death isn't all that it seems to be. It is also a regulator of our world. And so, although it came in because of sin, it also controls our world. I know it takes the good people away as well, because all of us are mortal. But it also brings about this regulator of things, just in the same way that pain monitors our condition. So if you get a sudden pain, then you know, and right away you start to take care, do you not? So there's a little survey of things. And you may have a difficult job to do. If you're a man, you've got a job that, you know, they just keep on putting the pressure on you with your job. You've just done a good job and then they put the pressure on. And the pressure on again. And they say, I don't want it in 2 days' time, I want it tomorrow. And already it's in 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they say, I want it tomorrow. And then you've got to go home, you know. We're all aware of this. In fact, our world is under pressure, and nobody knows why it's under pressure either. Because supposedly we've got everything going for us, with a microchip and everything else, but everybody's chasing everything. And we're just, you know, you try to wonder sometimes. And the only way in which I cure that for myself is to step aside and say, what on earth's going on? Who's doing this? It's the kind of thing that unions do, isn't it? Give you 7 days for that. Now, that 7 days is totally artificial. But it's a grand psychological move, isn't it? Just like the boss says, if you're not all back at work by next Monday, I'm closing the factory. He hasn't got any intention of closing it, but it's part of a psychological pressure. And we're all aware of all these things that take place, are we not? That's our world. Now, Adam and Eve were therefore no longer allowed to be inhabitants of God's garden. That was fair enough. He'd given them one condition only, and they had said, no, we don't want it. So the Lord says, outside the garden then, and take with you your fear, your enmity, your sorrow, your sweat, and death. And so they went out into the world. But interestingly enough, they were given freedom of choice. That is, freedom of choice within the confines of these things. These would befall them in some form or another, but they had freedom of choice. Now, strangely enough, many of our sorrows and much of our pain comes because of our freedom of choice. This matter isn't as simple as you think it is, or might be tempted to think it is. Much of our sorrow comes through our personal choice. So the man who decides to smoke 50 to 60 cigarettes a day and gets lung cancer, he knows the connection between the two. He's prepared to take the risk. He happens to be one of the unfortunate ones for whom the risk was not right. But there's a direct connection. The young man who, without putting his helmet on, sets out on his motorbike at top speed, you know, and that marvellous way you can weave in and out, you know, of traffic, and then suddenly, just something ahead, he hits it, goes straight over the top, flies and breaks his neck. Much of our pain and sorrow comes to ourselves, as in our own relationship. Some of it is disguised. And so the baby's born deformed.